Welcome on a bumpy choo-choo train.
This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, December the 12th, and it is Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, where we look forward to your analysis of the things that threaten to put your lights out all week. Major issues. But let's get to what your thoughts are today. From New Jersey, Mike, you're starting off. Hello, Mike, you're on the air. Mike's not there. Okay. Let's try Rob from Florida. Are you on Florida?
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello, how are you?
Good. I just wanted to thank you for the email this morning. It was packed full of thoughts, which I knew it would be.
Oh, thank you so much for writing. I love hearing from the listeners, and yours was a very profound message, and I just needed to get – I was a little late, I think a couple of days late in getting to your note, but I did need to get that dispatched this morning.
Well, that's okay. I was calling because I wanted to talk about an aspect with – the Eric Gardner case and the Michael Brown case that I don't think many people are talking about or looking into, and that involves the actual application process that it takes to become a police officer. I wanted to share just some insights I have. At one point, I thought I wanted to be a sworn law enforcement officer, but it didn't end up working out for me, and I'm glad it didn't, but with my job and with my experience as an investigator, I've worked with numerous law enforcement agencies, you know, state, federal, local law enforcement, and have picked a lot of people's brains on the application process and what it takes. And the thing that I find that's extremely concerning is the lie detector portion of the test. Really, from talking to a lot of law enforcement people, the thing that I understand is that either there's people that really have been very straight-laced and can pass it with flying colors, and typically those people are they see things as very black and white. They don't have sympathy. They don't understand that people can just make mistakes, but they'll move on from it and learn from it. And then at the other time, there's people who know how to manipulate it, and I would say are more of the psychopathic, sociopathic people who have no remorse for the things they've done in their life and don't have a guilty conscience. And a way I can prove that is I spoke to a law enforcement officer about this, and he admitted to me that before he joined the force, he smoked marijuana 200 to 300 times and even sold it a year up to before he became a law enforcement officer. And I said, well, how did you beat the lie detector test like that? You know, I mean, that seems like it'd be impossible. He said to me, Rob, I found out how it works, and I beat the system. You know, I established a rapport with the person issuing the polygraph, and I was able to convince myself I did not do this. And it worked. And he said in his experience, you know, some of the best cops he's worked with were people that have done things in their life and have made mistakes, because they can reason with people that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and they can understand the mistakes they've made. And he cited even that his own partner used to steal cars before he became a police officer. But the thing that strikes me, I understood what he was saying when he made that point, but the thing that strikes me as concerning is the point of, you have people that can take these tests and they can feel no sympathy or empathy for what they've done. They have no remorse and they sleep fine at night and don't have a guilty conscience. And that speaks to Darren Wilson in his interview when he says, you know, with ABC News that I sleep well at night and I know I didn't do anything wrong. I believe he probably is absolutely truthful when he's saying that, because I think the system caters individuals with that type of mindset to be in law enforcement, and I think that's a very dangerous thing.
Really interesting thing to ponder. Thank you so much for offering it today, Rob.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Yatrice?
Great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing good, and I want to wish everybody in the PRN audience a happy weekend, if we can call
Thank
it
you.
A happy weekend.
Thank
but,
you.
You know, over the last couple of weeks, dealing with the Darren, dealing with the Michael Brown murder and the Eric Garner murder, you know, a lot of things have been uncovered in regards to police brutality, police torture. You know, I was talking to my dad not too long ago, and, you know, it's like he says, this has been going on for decades. And he's actually glad that, you know, it's all being uncovered. However, it's like when black folks, you know, used to just, you know, tell how we had dealings with the police, it was sort of like, oh, you guys are just being paranoid, or you guys are just, you know, being crazy, or you just don't like the police. No, it's actual experiences that we've all had. You know, even to this day, you know, when I talk to white people about police, it's like they don't, you know, they either surprised about the dealings I've had with police, or they just, you know, some of them just don't believe it. And like, I've never been to jail. You know, I've never had a record. You know, I'm college educated, and I have no tattoos, or I don't look like I'm a thug or anything like that. So it's like, but, you know, I still, you know, there's still, you know, harassment. And what's interesting was, I was at church Sunday, and the pastor at the church basically, who was a black man, basically described to his congregation about the experience he had with law enforcement. Apparently, there was a young man who was working at the church for him who was having his lunch break, and the cops just rolled up and started harassing him. So, you know, the pastor came out and asked, okay, what's going on? And the cop who was there just basically told him, you know, get the F back. It's none of your business. So I guess he didn't know that our pastor has the phone number to the watch commander's to the watch commander's phone. So he had to call him up and tell him he's got a rude cop out here that's, you know, harassing us. But basically in that particular, because the church that I go to, the neighborhood I grew up in, and I've always had issues with those police in that particular district. Because what's also interesting, and anybody that grew up in that neighborhood would know, that right down the street from that district, there are like about four or five crack houses there, and they've been sitting there for years. So it's like, what, you know, like, how do you have crack houses on the same block as the police station? So it's an interesting thing with police and law enforcement. But the one thing I've always said, and I know a lot of my cop friends and even cop relatives don't like it, is the best way, I think, if they really want to change the way policing is, they have to do deep fundamental changing. And I said, the first thing I would start with is whatever area you're patrolling in, you have to live there. I'll make it military style. Listen, you have to have a house there. And if you don't have one, I would say the city or whatever police department has to provide one for you. And you have to live there while you patrol there. I think that will be a start, if you ask me.
Because, but you can't just like regulate where people live. I mean, simply because a person has a particular job, does that person have to forfeit the right of choice of where to live?
Well, I mean, that will probably be the case, you know, if you're arguing against it. But I mean, I say you have to have radical changes to the system, and that's the first thing I had thought of. You know, I would treat it like I said, if you join the military, you don't have a choice to where you live at. You know, you have to be stationed there.
Right, you do. One of the things I think would be very helpful is when police officers are involved in any infraction, they should immediately be compelled to take out their own insurance. And because when you look at it, and I used to look at the reports from the New York City Comptroller's Office, how many millions of dollars of taxpayers' dollars are going to people who are winning lawsuits against the city. So mm-hmm. One thing is to, you know, there's no reason, for example, that we had a Daniel Pantaleo with four lawsuits successfully won against him, and he still is on the force. I just don't understand that. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that might not be a bad idea to make police officers who have been to some degree, not the serious infractions, they should just be dismissed from the force. But when there are disciplinary actions taken against them, or lawsuits filed against them, or complaints filed against them, they should be tagged as a potential danger, because we know statistically the police officers who are the greatest danger on the force are on the force between 0 and about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And those people, if they do come into the purview of some kind of scrutiny because of their conduct, should be made to take out their own insurance, because the city should not be carrying the insurance for such individuals or assuming the risk of insurance for such individuals.
And that's not a bad idea. And one more thing, and the only reason I brought up the housing thing is because Alton Maddox even said it, that, you know, policemen are basically like standing armies. So, you know what? I just, like, treat them as a standing army.
Okay.
So
it's a good point that you make. But it's interesting. You know, I mean, these are some of the discussions that need to be had. From a legal point of view, could a particular person be compelled to live in a particular place simply because of the job he or she has? And you made your point. So let's see how people react to it. Thanks so much for your call today.
Thank you.
Thank you. From New York, Joel, you're on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And how are you today?
I'm pretty good. I'm calling for you from the outside, taking a brisk walk in a cold day. So if I appear to be panting, I apologize. Okay. You know, a couple of weeks ago, you had a really warm appreciation of Marion Barry. Remember that?
Yes.
A really, really wonderful appreciation. And I think I might have mentioned on a previous call that when I was just a young kid at 18 years of age and training for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at Fisk University, my trainees were John Lewis and Marion Barry. And Marion then, this was 61 or so, I think it was about 26, 27, and when you're a skinny 18-year-old kid, a person who's, pardon me, who's 7 or 8 years older than you appears to be an old sage, you know, and we sort of treated him as such. After all, he's really one of the founding members of SNCC. And I remember, and it really relates to everything that you've been talking about over the past few weeks, I remember that there was one thing that he said that really stayed with me and still stays with me these many decades later, and that is that one should never confuse tactical considerations with your ideals. And that tactical consideration should always be in support of your ideals and not vice versa. Because if it's the other way around, then it becomes a pointless operation. And
could you explain that concept a bit?
Sure. Well, in terms of the civil rights revolution of the 1960s, we wanted to establish public accommodation rights for everyone and voting rights for everyone. There were many, you know, local narratives in which many kinds of tactical decisions had to be made that led to certain compromises. And one always had to recognize that these compromises may have been necessary for the moment, but if they became an end in and of themselves, then the ultimate aim, which is the enfranchisement of African Americans and the expansion of public accommodation rights to everyone, would get lost. See what I'm saying?
Yes. I just needed it explained so
okay.
You know, we could get it together. Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And you know, that really stands in, I'm sorry to say, in juxtaposition to, what I have to say about Marion was that with all, through all the trials and tribulations that he had to experience, he maintained that sense of idealism throughout his career. You know, parenthetically, Lenin, in a way, said the same thing, one step backwards in order to take two steps forward. And Barry's career, in my view, really stands in juxtaposition, I'm sorry to say, to that of John Lewis, who I still have great, and everyone should have great admiration, you know, for him, for his great moral courage and his heroism. And he practically had his skull fractured in May of 1963 in behalf of the movement. But since then, he has become a kind of party regular. I think we all know that. And I think he would probably say, well, these are the things that you have to do to get things done. But I'm sorry, I just can't agree with that. And when I think about, you know, what has been going on over the past 2 weeks, ever since the grand jury decisions have been rendered, it seems to me that we have to keep in mind who we're dealing with and what we're dealing with. And I think that it's fine for people to go on and on about cameras, you know, on police helmets and all of that. And of course, we want, you know, these kinds of things, but they really represent palliatives in my view. And we, now that there's so much organization out there in many, many different cities around the country, we've got a mobilization that started. And this represents a real opportunity for us. So we have to, I think, really be careful and ask ourselves what we want and why we're doing what we're doing. And I would say that the ideal objectives that we should keep in mind are pretty simple. We should demand that the federal government end this pernicious war on drugs, because the war on drugs only inflames violence wherever it appears, internationally, in the puppet states of Colombia, of Mexico, and the puppet vassal state of Honduras. Ordinary people by the thousands have been massacred by this. And in the United States and in these other countries, what happens is that the military, the paramilitary, and the police all become criminalized because of this. And in the United States, what you see are police forces out on the hunt to try to, you know, try to bust black kids. So we have to always keep that in mind. That I'm not saying that before the war on drugs started, in a formal sense, there wasn't this kind of hunting of blacks. I mean, we both know that in the 1940s and the 50s, the organized crime injected enormous amounts of heroin into African American communities, and it was open season on them for police forces. And there'll be lots of pushback and resistance to this call, but at least it exposes the elites for what they are. The second thing that we have to do is end the militarization of police completely. That means not only not giving back these weapons and weapon systems to the federal government, but scuttling them. Nobody should have these weapons. And it also, this objective also allows us to make the connection between what the police are doing and what a military economy, a permanent war economy, does to an entire culture. And the third thing that we have to do is make the connection between the kind of brutality and criminalization of African Americans that goes on and the scourge of mass incarceration. And we should connect those two and talk about it all the time. And finally, I think we should end the criminalization of the mentally ill and get the police out of the mentally ill business. And by the way, with regard to the mentally ill, I thought that the comment by Rob was very, very interesting, the comment that opened the program. But I would add to that that I think that anyone who wants to be a policeman or a policewoman must be therapeutically evaluated. He or she must have a real therapeutic examination, not some kind of surface, a survey, superficial kind of thing, but because it's so obvious that so many of these police forces are attracting people who of sociopathic and psychopathic inclination. So I think these are the kinds of things that we should talk about, because what it does is it then takes this problem and places it within the arena of national concerns. And it allows us also to move away from identity politics.
And to take that
and to apply it to the coalition building that's needed to transform society.
Thank you so much, Joel. You put a lot on the table today. Thank you for that. Right. Thank you so much.
Right.
We go next to Berkeley, California. Harvey, you're with us.
Hello, wonderful Eugene.
Hello, wonderful Harvey. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. We are quantangled. We are one.
Yes.
Well, today I'd like to speak about profit over people and why is our economic system so punitive and can we change it for the better? And I think we have to recreate our banking system to help us and not hurt us. We're seen as a commodity to a large variety of worldwide corporations, and as such, you have debtors' prisons, spiraling interest rates. As you fall, if you stumble, we live in a society that if you stumble, the system, the economic system, pulls you down. The cash checking places for poor people, those guys are vultures. And of course, the rich people, the richer they are, the less interest they pay. At the same time, our elderly, who have less earning power, they enter into it. It seems that there's more of an economic burden. Instead of a decrease in the economic burden, the promise of working a lifetime in retirement. And, of course, certain multinational corporations pay no taxes. So I think that we have to switch it around to people over profit and work at those issues, especially as we enter a time when there's going to be more and more robots, 3D printers, and artificial intelligence to soak up even more of the jobs that we have. We have to start seeing each other in a more quantangled way and work at an economic system that's a benefit to all of us. Thank you, Therese.
Thank you, Harvey. Thanks so much. From Dallas, Texas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Oh, greetings to you, Therese, and greetings to the PRN audience.
Thank you.
Well, you, you had a very informative week all of this week, and it has been most interesting. And the piece that really stood out for me was with Dr. Gerald Horn and what you were doing when you were covering the CIA documents, well, part of it that was released and everything else that has been going on up there in that part of the country. A few things that I wanted to touch on really quickly here, because someone sent something to me, and I heard your program yesterday where you said you were going to New York and you were going to be, for the centennial of the ancestor, Dr. Clark, you're going to be helping with that celebration.
Yes.
But, they'd also touched on what was going on with Attorney Alton Maddox as a result of him coming on the airwaves and you know, shedding some light and informing us. He's getting some. He also is being put in the cross here for some retaliatory action. So I don't know if you mentioned that or if you are at liberty to talk about what's going on with Attorney Maddox. But that, but that's very, very troubling. So if you can touch on that before you go off air, if you, if that's okay.
Well, I want him to explain it himself, and that's what he'll do next week. Yes.
Okay, then. So I'm not going to say anything then on with going on with that then. But to get back to the situation and what with all of your previous callers that you're touching on with what's going on with Ferguson and everything else, what this CIA information has shown us is it has shown us this inhumanity of how this system of governance that we've all been in existence under at least for the known 500 years, how it has propagated itself and how it has propped itself up and how it has been able to perpetuate itself and carry on. Because what they went over there and what they have done to those detainees, and it goes right back to the same thing with what happened with Abner Louima, where he was sodomized with objects, what happened in Chicago with John Birch and what he did with some detainees from as young as 8 and 9 year old young males. They picked up and handcuffed them and brutalized them. And it's always this sexual obsession that they have with people's sex organs and going into their orifice, you know, their anus, and doing all of these atrocious things that these people have been going around the world doing. And you know, to me, Therese, I don't see, I guess because I'm not a sociopath, or I'm not a psychopath, and I don't see anything objective, because if I have to do something in order to dispatch you and get you out of my way, I can go ahead and just put a bullet in you and just move on and go on to the next victim. I don't have to stick around and stick knives in you and put plungers and do all of these other things to a body, urinate on you, defecate on you, and do all of these things that these people are that these people do, sleep deprivation, and you know all of these things that you read about in these reports. And then Barbara Feinstein, and she could say, we are a system of laws. As I said repeatedly, this country and this white supremacist system is based on laws. Laws that they made that they can break, but the people that they're oppressing, you have to obey those laws and stay within those laws or else. Because everything that every civilization that have gotten, that have broken out under white supremacist rule, they've gotten by breaking those laws that were put in place to keep them down. And you are not going to get anything like when the president came on BET and was saying, making all of these nonsense about, you know, you can demonstrate, but demonstrate peacefully. It's oxymoronic, because what's the point in a demonstration? A demonstration is to disrupt the way how things are going as usual. So it's not going to be peaceful, because you are restricting the flow of business from going as people are used to it going. So it's not going to be, but it seems that any time when it comes to people, we're always being told you can do whatever you want to do as long as you do it peaceful. Then, you know, because it means to say they're going to ignore you, they're going to put you aside, and, you know, we ain't going to worry about them, because they're just going to march around with a sign and sing some songs or whatever. You know, they're not picking up guns, and they ain't doing nothing crazy like that, so we ain't got to worry about them. But everybody else can be free to express themselves and say whatever it is. The United States can leave this border and go all the way to Asia and Africa and disrupt other people's lives and do it in a very violent manner. It is okay for them to do so. They could go all the way over to the Ukraine and prop up all of these dictatorships, overthrow governments and give people guns and bullets and drop bombs and do all of these things, but it's okay for them to do it. But when it comes to people within this border trying to establish themselves and trying to overthrow this yoke of oppression upon them, then no, you are doing something wrong, and no, you can't do it. This country came about as a means of violence. That is how they came here. These are a bunch of people that invaded another land, murdered the people, stole from these people, and they've been on the restrictive covenants ever since to prevent these rightful owners from coming back and taking what's rightfully theirs. That's what they have done. So when I hear all of these people talking about these illegal people who coming in here illegally, how the heck did you get here? Because I'm sure that George Washington and none of them, they didn't come through with no passport. I didn't get nothing stamped and says, okay, now you can come on in and you can stay. They all came up in here illegal.
Okay. Much to think about, Sarah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Yatrice.
Thank you, and have a good weekend yourself. From California, Dan, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. The rain's starting to slow down a little bit. I just wanted to throw my hat in the circle as far as the police brutality that's going on and the failure of the Justice Department demonstrating justice to people. And what comes to my mind is it seems as if what we're doing is we're trying to eliminate the danger of a rattlesnake bite by cutting off its rattle. And what I mean by that is...
Now, that is funny. That is, I'm just visioning that. That is very, that's funny.
What I mean by that is that the largest union in the United States is the police union, and that every officer that belongs to that union takes orders from that union. If that union tells the police officers not to go to work tomorrow, they will not show up. They do what the union says, and as long as the union doesn't step in with training, demanding that the officers are trained in a better way to be a little more civil to human beings, putting these individual officers in jail is not going to solve the problem. It may show a little twinkle of a light in the darkness, but it's not going to solve the problem. So I think people need to address their grievances with the police union because, like Hoffa, you know, Hoffa told the Kennedys that he was more powerful than they are. You know, of course, we don't know where Hoffa is, but he was telling the truth. He said he could shut down New York City with one phone call. And so these unions, all these officers are responsible to these unions, and these unions are supporting the police brutality and the weaponization and the militarization of. So I just think that the union heads of the police department shouldn't be let off the hook as if they're not responsible for what's going on, because they are.
Well, in fact, that very point that you're making comes into play in one of the most recent police killings in Brooklyn with Akai Gurley, the young man who was surprised by a police officer. He was trying to go down the stairwell, and the police officer was coming up and fired on him.
Exactly.
Because he was surprised. But the story is that after he shot Gurley, officer shot Gurley, the first thing he did was run and call the union rep rather than seek medical attention for the man he shot.
Yep, that's exactly correct. Because the unions are who's gonna make the changes, not the individual. The police chiefs of all these police departments all answer to the union. Everybody answers to the union. So I think that's where the pressure needs to be applied.
Could it successfully be applied in your view?
Yes.
How so?
Well, I'm not really familiar with the hierarchy of the of that particular union, but they have to be held responsible. See, they're responsible for all the members of their union, although that right now they're standing back like no one's even demanding anything from them. And once people begin to demand that they curb their protocol, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. But if that union tells their officers, the people that belong to that union, that they have to take a different approach, they will do that.
Well, thank you for your input today. Thanks, Dan, for your call.
Thank you.
And have a good weekend. Ma'at from New York, you're on the air.
Good day to all the family out there, and have a peaceful and safe holiday season. It's also called Saturnalia. But I want to address Sarah, who on a recent phone call I made, I think she misunderstood. First of all, I corrected myself, I said commission on truth, and I said, after I said reconciliation, I said or inquiry. She also misunderstood what is something that is a prime representation of European supremacy, which she was just recently talking about, and that is the creation of race. There's an excellent DVD, Illusion, that every so-called white person wakes up with and goes from cradle to grave. That's a perfect example. That's the fact, and I very much understand the reality. I was not talking about anything like color blindness. Okay, Sarah. Now, a couple quick points on this, the first part of the conversation. There was a gentleman who sued who had a very high IQ, and the police wouldn't put him on a particular department. And he took it to a court, and the police department won. So that's something that we need to look at. If you have a high IQ, if you're smart, they don't want you, and they get away with it even in the higher court. The second part is on community policing. I've heard some of these Uncle Tom city council people here in New York asking for that, which makes absolute sense, because the issue is an occupying army. And when you have people with all these killings, maimings, injuries, humiliations, you do have the right to say we need people in the community, because when they go back to the neighborhood to sleep, they're not going to be doing the most outrageous things. And lastly, I want to put something on the table, Utrice, and like your response. I know I do it with emails, but this morning, Guns and Butter, are you familiar with Bonnie Faulkner's program on KPFA in Berkeley, and they rebroadcast it on...
You're in and out, but are we losing you?
Yes, I know. Just try to hang in there with me. Can you hear me a little better now? My phone
yes,
is breaking down. And who she had on, and also being featured by Gary Noe on the 17th in a special fundraiser for his sister station. That's going to be, I think, from 10 to 6, and he's going to have 30 people on the police state, and the one that he mentioned was John Whitehead. So my question to you, this is someone who takes on war on kids, the suspensions, which of course targets us, the no-knock warrants, and also ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. So his new book, A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State, I'm booking him on two other shows, and I like your thoughts because we'd like to hear his ideas on Alton's situation, which is unprecedented. We'd like to know if he has any help for Reverend Pinckney, because he does have a hundred or so attorneys around the country that use.
You've written me a couple of notes about John Whitehead and the Rutherford Institute. Is that the same person?
Yes, yes. And then I wrote you because I wasn't sure whether you were familiar with him. And
I'm very much familiar with the Rutherford Institute.
Let me listen to you over the air.
All right, thank you. One of the things that, you know, I tend to be kind of, how should I say, I tend to have my own mind in booking guests. And it's nothing personal. It's just that I have in mind what's important to know. And people, I mean, I like suggestions. People do have suggestions, and many of the suggestions are great. But I also like the idea of hearing from people who are not normally heard from. And, you know, I tend to have my own mind in that regard. So I understand. I've read quite a bit of his work. There are issues that I have with the Rutherford Institute. Very often, very conservative groups they adopt a different stance on issues. But at the heart of it, you do have to measure that against what the overarching agenda is. So I do this on a case-by-case basis. That's the best I could say for now. DX, you're on the air from Los Angeles.
Hello, Utrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I'd like to wish everybody out there a wonderful weekend. Go out and do something fun and take care of yourselves. what I wanted to do today there's so much going on, and these issues with the police get me so worked up, and I don't want to be all worked up today.
So focus.
I would like to talk about the torture report from the CIA that just came out. Very interesting things about it. I haven't read, of course, there's lots of pages. I haven't read all of them, but I did download it and read some of it, and I've heard other people commenting on it on other shows. And a couple of things were real, very, very striking to me. First of all, the way this report was compiled and how long it took and how the CIA basically pumped the Senate and stretched out a report that was supposed to be done in a year, year and a half, to 4 years, basically told the Senate to sit down and shut up and wait. They even filtered it through a private contractor for sensitive information and told them, you'll get to see after they see it. And I mean, this just shows me. Also, you know, there was the scandal of them wiretaping the Senate, including Feinstein, I believe it was, wasn't it?
The computers of her staff.
Right, exactly.
Right,
so
committee
it
staff,
shows
yes.
me we have a shadow government going on here, that the people we think we put in charge or ostensibly put in charge, they don't run anything. And it just shows we have a rogue CIA, too. A couple of other striking things about it, too. One was that in here they detail in a couple of places that George Bush, basically George Bush was as dumb as we thought he was. They didn't tell him about the extent of the torture until 2006. And, of course, the war on terror started right around 2001 or 2. He had no idea what was going on up until 2006, not to relieve him of any blame because, of course, he knew it then. So they told him about waterboarding and all that in 2006. Also, a very
Dick Cheney was on ABC, I believe it was, or Fox, one of the two, and he did say that the president was fully cognizant of everything.
Right, but only this report says he only found out about it in 2006. Now, I'm pretty sure that Dick Cheney knew what was going on the whole time. He pretty much was the default president anyway. When Bush was in there, we all know that. He basically wielded way more power than Bush. The interesting thing, too, is about Colin Powell. They say in here that they didn't tell Colin Powell. So Colin Powell probably didn't know anything about what was going on until probably the last couple of years, and that's probably why he resigned, I believe. So the thing is,
Tell Powell because he's likely to blow his stack.
Right,
if he
exactly.
finds out.
I was going to quote that. That's exactly what the report says, is that they didn't tell Colin Powell because he was likely to blow his stack. Yeah, and so several years ago, there was a hit piece. That's all you can call it, a hit piece that was done by ABC to try and implicate Powell. I don't know if you remember that, but I kind of remember that. And now I'm thinking, you know, they were just out to get him. You know, they were trying to basically be probably because they thought he had a presidential bid in mind or something. They probably wanted to muddy him up. So this shows me that this CIA is way out of control. They're way out of control, and they need to be reined in. But I always said that, you know, we have a shadow government going on. I always knew that anyway. What we need to do is really, you know, get some people with some teeth in there who are going to bring these people to account. I don't even know if it can be done. I think these people are fully in control, and they know it. They know they're in control.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for your call today, DX, and have yourself a good weekend. Sean from New York, you're on the air.
Hello, you treat?
Yes, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Fine, thank you. And you too, I hope?
I'm good. You know, to kind of piggyback off of what DX was talking about with the torture report, I watched Dianne Feinstein the other night on CNN, and I wanted to throw up. Because I also listened to you, I think, the following day she gave that interview.
Right.
With regard to this is not who we are and, mm-hmm. you know, this is not our morals. I had to literally throw up when I saw that interview because, again, and I tell people this all the time, that the definition of hypocrisy, if you look in the dictionary, is going to have a map of the United States of America. Because the hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance is so strong, you know, that, you know, how do you sit there and believe these lies? How do you sit there and tell me that, you know, all of a sudden everybody's got religion on torture? Nobody knew anything. I personally believe they all knew what was going on. Nobody wanted to say anything about it because they sanctioned it. And now that it's been blown up in the press, everybody's in CYA mode right now. And that's just my take on it. And to your point that you discussed yesterday with regard to torture, it's embedded in the American psyche. It's embedded in American culture deeply because, like you said, slavery, the wars with the Indians, all of that was torture, no matter how you break it down. Jim Crow was torture. Lynching was torture. All of these things were torture. And, you know, this is part of who America is. And, again, it's the hypocrisy that reeks through the airways with regard to these incidents. It's just mind-blowing how people can sit there and buy this stuff.
And then we have the report delivered by somebody who still has not been investigated over mm-hmm. this non-bidding a contract that her husband has to sell off in excess
right.
of $81 billion of Postal Service property. And he has formed his own company to buy the property that he's selling and then to sell it again. So, you know, it is so corrupt all around. It's just so corrupt. It's just it's sickening.
It is. It's exactly corrupt all around. And, you know, now you're looking at they just passed the bill last night to keep the government from shutting down. They got provision in that bill that allow Wall Street to trade derivatives and go unregulated once again. And I'm like, again, here we going down this road again.
But and not only that, none other than the president, none other than the president urged the Democrats to vote for it.
That's exactly right. He urged them to vote for it, and in fact, Elizabeth Warren and Nancy Pelosi basically came out and railed against the White House and his administration for supporting this bill. So again, it's funny. People love to bash Cornel West, but Cornel West, in his assessment of Barack Obama, is dead on point. He is basically a mascot of Wall Street, and why people don't see this now is beyond me. And with regard to Eric Garner case, I'm completely disgusted, completely and utterly disgusted with what I've seen from that grand jury. And it speaks to the intrinsic racism and bias that is embedded in America. It is completely awful, that verdict that they came back with.
Thank you, Sean, for your participation today. Thank you so much for the call.
No problem. All right.
And the final call for the day would be from Louisiana. Shelby, you're on the air.
Hey, Sister Utrice, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you in Louisiana
today? Wonderful. Oh, I got some sun out here and everything. Now, you know, Sister Utrice, I need to put things in order. First, I truly enjoy listening to your show.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. You know, now I'm going to tell you why, because the information that I get off of your show, I've independently verified some of the things, not all of the things, but some of the things that you've said on your show. Now, you said a while back that you wrote that on the front page of your newspaper that Reverend Jesse Jackson was a charlatan. Is that the word that you use, Sister Utrice?
Yes, yes.
Now, you know, there's a book called The Man to See by Evan Thomas, and it's a book about the trial lawyer. Did you know Edward Bennett Williams?
I heard him, but
he was a trial lawyer. But anyway, he's saying in this book on page 463, he uses three terms to describe Jesse Jackson. One was a lowlife, his direct quote, a medicine man, and the third one is the word that you use, a charlatan. So I just want to say that, I just want to repeat that the information, now, I just need to say that your show is for the future, Sister Eutrice. What I mean that your show is for the future is the same thing that why we take medicine. It's not for today. It's for the future. Because your show is telling us something that, like medicine, is hard to go down. And the truth is painful. But in the future, it will be better for you. So your show is sort of like medicine. Right now, it's hard to deal with. You're kind of giving some things that make us mad, make us angry. But if we deal with... I'm being honest with you, Sister Eutrice. And for the future, it will be better for you. Now, Sister Eutrice, you also used to speak at the Slave Theater with Reverend Alton Maddox, right?
Yes.
Now, you know, one of my best friends used to speak there. Have you ever met or heard of Steve Coakley?
Of course.
Okay, of course. But so I just enjoyed you saying those things that you said at the Slave Theater, because there were some critical points that I learned out of there. You know, one of the shows that you did was a reading between the lines.
Yes.
That's a classic. And you did another one about the bourgeois leadership or something like that. So those shows were good. But Sister Eutrice, I know I'm running out of time, but I just want to gleam or try to understand what can we do. I know you, a lot of people call into your show and they give solutions. They describe the problems, and it's very important that we understand the problems, what we're up against, but it's also likewise to figure out some of the solutions. What can we do? Now, what I mean by solution, Sister Eutrice, I mean something that we can do day in and day out, not something big, something that we can do every day to try to deal with a lot of the problems that people call in and talk about. You know, getting with like-minded people, starting small groups, starting book clubs, investment clubs, really reading between the lies and the lines, and getting at the root causes of certain problems. Because it's not likely that if you don't get to the root cause of a certain problem, it's not likely that you're going to get to solving the problem. Usually, a lot of people that I talk to, they deal with the symptoms. They do not use critical thinking and get to the root causes of certain problems.
Well, you have a very strong point there, and that's one of the things that I think needs to happen. People need to start talking and fleshing out these solutions themselves. I think that is also part of the process. People need to have active participation in crafting the solution to the problems themselves. That is part of the leadership.
Now, Sister Eutrice, in my experience, it's been two things that led me to believe that two types of people are the most dangerous people on the planet. Those people that's got nothing to lose and those people that's got everything to lose. So I think it's going to come down to a fight between the people that's got nothing to lose and the people that's got everything to lose. And the people that's got nothing to lose is going to win.
Well, we hope that in between that time, that we have some good thinking going on, because, you know, in the end, when it gets to that point of annihilation, victory, if it comes by way of annihilation, really isn't victory, is it?
So, you know, can I leave you with this last quote?
Okay.
It says, "He that will not reason is a bigot. He that cannot reason is a fool. He that dare not reason is a slave." And I'm neither a bigot nor a fool nor a slave, Sister Eutrice.
I get you.
Thanks a lot for taking my call, and have a good weekend.
And it was worth waiting for. Thank you, Shelby, for calling in from Louisiana today.
Okay.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our program. We had an exciting hour of just a full range of thought here. And this is what makes this program so incredible, that it is the shared responsibility of everybody putting in their own little flavor into the soup. And that's great. That's exactly what this program is about, sharing ideas and thoughts. Some of them may be a little strong, but, you know, we have to grow up enough to understand that it is coming from a sincere place, and people are expressing the views they genuinely feel. It's not about upsetting anybody or getting anybody on edge. It's just simply strong talk, and that's what we need to encourage. Not disrespectful in any way, but very, very strong opinions, and that's great. That's exactly where we need to go. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You want to stay tuned for that. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. There's a project I'm going to be starting talking about that on next week, and that is to pay tribute to this master teacher that we have had in our midst for many years, Dr. John Henrik Clark. I've been asked to just coordinate a celebration in tribute to his 100th birthday. And that will be at the Convent Avenue Baptist Church in Harlem. I'm going to be up in New York, and we'll hopefully have a chance to meet with each other and have a chance to talk and see my voice. And I'll see your voice as well. So thank you so much. It is always a great pleasure and a wonderful privilege to be in your esteemed company. I'm very lucky, and I know it.